Welcome to another edition of Once Upon an Island, Tales from Lopez. I'm Ali Smalders, and with me is Laurie Harrison. And today we have two guests. Laurie, would you introduce our guests?
Sure. We're sitting here today with Krista Millay and Corwin Martin. We are recording this show in January 2011. And you two. So you all arrived on Lopez in February of 1987. Can you tell us a little bit about why you chose Lopez and what brought you here? And maybe a little bit about your first experiences with finding a place to stay.
Chris, would you like to go ahead?
Well, we first rented a little cabin that had no
electricity
and somewhere in Lopez Hill for one weekend. And it was in January, and it was cold and windy and rainy, and we loved it. We just loved, you know, we said, oh, we're going to move here. We'll have to move here. So a couple of months later, we did. We found a rental place for, what was it, $300 or something? Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness.
And we moved here. It only took two trips and a couple of vans.
Oh. And you came up from Seattle, was it?
Yeah, the Bothell, Woodinville area. We both had places there.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about the other accommodations that you had after you had your first little places and what they were like.
Well, the first place that we...
Rented.
It was on right on Fisherman's Bay, across from the Galley Restaurant. And it had a, we had a tough time for a while getting much work done because we were always watching the bay and the change.
The water pattern.
The water patterns.
You know. Yeah. So if you're not used to looking at water, you know, it's pretty fascinating.
And we come to realize that any time that we looked across the water on Fish Bay Road, and there was more than three cars, the ferry must have let out.
So it was quiet back then.
It was very quiet.
Oh, yeah.
Very quiet. There was hardly in the place that we rented. We didn't have next door neighbors right on top of us. So from there, we ended up moving to Shirley Wright's Grayling Gallery. The landlords were selling the house that we were in, so Shirley accommodated us by improving her upstairs loft, where we had a big living space along with a beautiful studio space.
And it had French doors that opened onto nothing. All it was a little thin screen in front of it, and Shirley had told us a story once. She taught a class, and the screen wasn't there yet. But they were, you know, kind of in the... Bernie was helping her build it and fix it. Anyway, the lady put her purse on after the class and was ready to walk out, and it was one story down, you know, and she just grabbed her. So then they put the screen in front of it in some way, but that was the nicest thing, that big... French door.
And the light there on Hummel Lake. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the skylights.
The skylights in the studio. There is where we really got started with improving our serigraphs, which is a form of screen printing. It's just a fancy name for screen printing.
And both of you worked on that?
Mostly Chris worked on it, but... I filled in on a few areas when needed. But in that period, of time, we were able to improve our kind of notoriety and financial by doing silkscreen posters for major resort areas. And Chris would stay back at the studio and do all of the artwork and printing on the posters while I went out and did a lot of the sales and grunt work out in the field. And whenever we took a vacation back in those days, we made sure that it was a working vacation. One time, I remember we went back to visit my relatives in the Midwest, so we made sure to stop at all the ski resorts in between Idaho and through Colorado and pick up a commission poster. And then when we got home, then Chris really had to work.
But I always found it a challenge, you know,
yeah.
Because when somebody gives you a problem and says, I would like this, and it has to have the mountains in the back and the ski and somebody playing in front, I like doing that because it's kind of like saying, can you do it? Sure we can.
Mm-hmm.
I've never had anybody that didn't like the art, you know, it's always successful. Oh, my.
And these were the years when you were establishing yourself as an artist.
Then, yeah, and then we started having shows and, you know, different galleries. And, of course, we were, like you mentioned before, all the gift shops and frame shops and you know. And the list is really long about all the different places that we made posters. And now, these years later, we get inquiries about... what about this poster that you had in Roach Harbor in so-and-so, and how much is it worth now, you know?
Oh.
And lots of email questions and stuff, you know. And we established a price and says, well, there's no galleries out there selling it, you know, but they all sold out. So anyway, that's another whole business, art business story. That's kind of...
But that's fascinating because in some ways the posters that you made then show a place that may have changed by now, and somebody really needs to know what it looked like.
Like a poster of the village overlooking, you know, posterized and then looking into the bay. Well, you probably can't do that anymore. There's all these
stuff
other buildings
in between.
Now.
Yeah.
Right.
But I found it interesting that you said not the big galleries, but the smaller ones and the gift shops. In other words...
Yeah, in smaller towns.
And smaller towns,
They have a need for art, and they might not even have thought about it. Like, we went to Linden one time, you know, and
oh,
said,
my goodness.
Hey, Linden, they got a windmill. I bet they want the poster of it. Sure enough, they did.
Okay.
They took us on the tour of all the way up into the windmill and everything, you know, and they put the tulips in the front on the poster and the windmill and then, you know, and seagulls flying and...
And so you were kind of capturing the history of these littler places along the west coast from Canada down through Washington or Oregon?
We did Prince Rupert.
Whistler, lots of Whistler.
Whistler. What was the name of the...
Canada.
The one clear up in that coal, they had the mill.
I don't remember.
And you did the picture of the... She did.
Oh, Powell River.
Powell River.
That was
The lady who owned the gallery insisted that her husband's yellow boat was in the...
And of course, this was a factory town, sort of a village, you know? It has the chimneys of the paper mill. They had to be in there, too, but you can't, you know, show the smoke coming out and everything.
Yeah.
Had to be white-colored, you know, so it's cheerful.
And all the way to Oregon?
Well, clear down to California, actually, all the way down
Colorado.
The coast.
Yeah.
And then back east to Colorado and
Arizona.
So.
They didn't like us at Aspen because we weren't expensive enough.
Oh.
They couldn't afford to carry us because their rental spaces in their galleries and is a lot higher, you know. Well, they have to carry higher items. They said, if your posters would be like $300, we would take you, but $35 is too cheap.
Yeah, fascinating.
Well, and tell us about this do or die approach to artwork and when you came to Lopez.
Well, we were both in our 40s, and our last child was in the last year of high school, and we had just gotten together as a couple, I guess you call it, dating and so on, and we decided that... no other jobs would do anymore. We were going both throw our lot together and be artists, and it was do or die, like you said. Mm-hmm. And I know we weren't going to die, but, you know, do. Mm-hmm. So in coming to Lopez really helped, because there were no distractions. All you could do was work. You could walk on the beach, come back at work, take a nap, work. And nobody would be calling. You know, there was no interruption, no salespeople, no kids to pick up everywhere. And, you know, all this was really concentrate on your art.
And that's when the art bloomed, and that's when we started to get more people taking us more seriously, so that we could go out and talk to them and find places.
And and the people on the island were really supportive too.
Yes,
were they?
Lots of people bought art, and some people still come to us and, oh, remember we bought your first whale print or the first poster, and that was very, very nice.
The first place that we hung our art was when Jeff and Nichols and his wife had the original Bay Cafe.
Okay.
And
yes,
and
yeah.
We hung our first serigraphs of the islands and sold a few.
Oh, yeah. We always sold something.
Yeah.
You know?
And to go back from that, maybe jump back into where we were at the Grayling Gallery, that is when we decided during that period of time to get some land and build ourselves. Mm. And we bought 5 acres off of Shoal Bay Lane, which or Port Stanley Road. And during that period of time, while we lived at Grayling, we built what is now our studio and gallery. So,
and you built it yourself?
We built everything.
Because nowadays people say, we're building our house, but it is not them. Yeah.
No.
It's somebody else who's doing the building.
Right.
Yeah.
But it used to be that you yourself.
Yeah. We did have some help from carpenters on the island, giving us tips and helping them.
Oh, yeah. And we made a lot of mistakes, too, that we have to redo or have been redoing over the last 20 years. Yeah. And when you have kind of a small budget, you don't use the best materials and so on. You know, you cut corners, and we had to redo some of those things.
So. I think one of the interesting parts is right after we bought the land, that's when we had the big Northwesters come in.
That was in 80,
89 and 90.
Yeah.
And we had Chuck...
Northeasters, they
were. Chuck Palmer McCartney had the sawmill, and he sawed all of our structural lumber that we used in the first building. So
it came from your own land,
came
then.
Came right off our own land.
Now, here's a question from a city girl.
Mm-hmm.
So how long did that lumber have to cure before you could build with it?
You can build with green.
You can, we stacked it for a year. And it's all pure dimensional lumber. It's actually 2x6s and 2x8s instead of the current way that you buy lumber. Today.
Did you all have experience building before you got out your hammer and your nails?
No.
No.
Simply no.
I've helped build a log cabin, and you had built a little addition like a garage at your house.
Yeah.
But beyond that, we didn't know
anything.
Come
to think of it, yes.
I just enclosed the garage. It wasn't...
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Nothing structural.
But I knew we could do it. You know, we worked well together.
Yeah.
And we communicate by drawing things on a piece of paper and then measuring it and then drawing it to scale and saying, well, how many 2x4s do you need to build this space and so on.
Very good.
You know, while we talk, this is, you know.
And being able to put it on paper and visualize it would be like, that's a gift in itself.
Oh, yeah. Now it's all done on computers, you know. We don't know how to do that, so...
Well, and I've been to your place, and aside from the buildings themselves being lovely works of art, the gardens there are enchanted gardens. And I know you said that when things got started there, it was just dirt. Which
bushes.
Is hard to imagine.
Blackberries and bushes.
Rose bushes, probably.
Yeah. Were the ponds there, or did you dig the... Not even the ponds.
There was a puddle there, sort of a wet area.
That's why we decided a good place for a pond.
Must be a reason, you know. We're sort of on a slope, you know, all the way down to the bay, so
yeah,
we're getting water from behind us, which is even higher up. And we know it's a good thing to collect that water here. And so we had two ponds, one in the front of the house, one in the back. Because it would be kind of a wetland if you, you know, continuously let it there. So
can you talk a little bit about the decisions you made about the kind of life you wanted to lead on Lopez as far as your physical surroundings, being off the grid and so forth, what those decisions were and how they may or may not have changed as time passed for you?
Well, the first thing that we decided was to be off the grid, and more for the aspect of the green aspect of it, because I remember back in the 60s when the oil embargo came along, and I lived in Los Angeles at that time, and there would just be lines and lines of cars backed up at filling stations. And I got kind of interested in products that were 12 volt, and it didn't make sense to go in and utilize the grid system the way it was here on the island. So the first thing we installed were solar panels and hooked up batteries to store the energy.
Yeah.
And we also decided to go into water catchment rather than to drill a well because of the bad water that we experienced, number one, on the island. And
tell about the shower stalls and the toenails turning yellow and my hair starts turning red at the Grayling Gallery. Because the water was so bad there.
It was very high iron content. And as I understand, also had arsenic in that particular well. It was pretty easy for us to say drain water is nice and soft and clean. And there's plenty of it in the Northwest.
Setting it up like that, too, for me, it was being in control. You're not dependent on somebody else or the storm shutting you down, and if you want to get better and improve on it, you can add as you go and have more power and have it where you want it. And we had lots of sunshine over there too, so it's the same with the water, you know. The rainwater is the best. We drink the rainwater. You've had tea, you know, we filter it and everything. So
it was peace of mind was one of the factors.
Yeah, and being in control is a very important thing, I think.
It was important for me because, you know, I've lived in a place where for quite a while when my children were little, where we had no water. Mm-hmm. The water was like a couple miles down the hill, down the mountain, you know, so you know how to use every drop of water. And this is a luxury for me. I have, how many tanks? How many gallons?
4,500 gallons right now.
And a lot of it is for gardening. You know,
most of
in the summer, you just attach the hose, open it up, there it goes. Well, there's a pump in between, you know.
And what was why did you decide not to bring water into the house by pipe? I know you bring it in by bucket nowadays.
We need more power for that, meaning we have to add another panel, and we need an on-demand pump which kicks in and makes a certain amount of noise every time you open the faucet, right? It's something I don't want to deal with at the moment. And it's sort of, it's a little bit of inertia, too, on Martin's part, because I don't think he's 100% sure how to do it, so we don't do it. Yes. Which is okay. I'll just get the bucket and bring the water in, you know.
Mm-hmm. I remember being surprised when I came to visit you. You know, coming in the house, it's a lovely house, beautiful furnishings, your gorgeous work on the artwork on the walls. And then looking around and discovering there was no refrigerator inside.
Yeah.
And discovering what being off the grid meant for you guys. You know, you've got what do you do for refrigeration for your food?
Ice we box out there.
Coleman ice just in the summertime. In the winter, you don't need any.
Yeah, you just leave the ice box open a little bit so the raccoons won't get in, but the cold air will get in.
Yeah.
The raccoons is a problem.
Yeah.
And you heat the with wood?
We originally started with heating with wood, but we have switched over to propane.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And you're using an outhouse?
Yes.
Yeah. Separate house.
It's separate house.
It's a composting situation.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, that we figured out for ourselves, and it works really well. So I don't know if we want to talk about it in detail.
What about showering and bathing? What kind of arrangements?
Well, have you seen the shower bags?
Yeah.
Well, you put warm water and cold water and hot water in until you like it. Carry it out there and
shower.
Take a shower.
Okay.
Yeah. And you know exactly how much you can use, how your suds and, you know, instead of running the water while you're washing yourself down and then, you know, so you know that you have only, what, 2 gallons is in there?
Approximately, yeah.
Yeah, I usually use 3 gallons. Carry a big bag on there, so I have lots of water.
Last spring, I got inspired. I knew since I built my place about 7 years ago that I wanted to have outdoor bathing facilities. So I had hot and cold running water piped onto the outside of my house, and so last year I finally found a friend who had an old bathtub sitting out in a field somewhere that they'd been watering the horses with for Lord knows how many years. We moved that into the backyard. So now I can just run the hose, hot and cold, to my bathtub and bathe out under the stars, which is a treat.
We've got a snorkel hot tub for that, you know.
You have a snorkel hot tub?
Yeah, it's a cedar tub. It seats one, or if you squeeze a little, two.
Yeah.
And it has a heater inside that you put your wood in. The heater is underwater. But you feed it from the top, and, you know, it heats the water.
Sweet. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Okay, so we were hearing about your serigraphs, and tell us a little bit then about where your work evolved from the serigraph prints. Or how it evolved.
Well,
I was always doing watercolors and different things and portraits for people. And we had some galleries that, you know, put on shows. And we had shows at the Grayling Gallery. And one day, somebody from the library approached me and said, would you like to do a big painting for behind the counter? You know, that was the old library stuff. And I said, sure. But it was a big wall space, and, you know, a big, huge frame is hard to do. So I did 3 pieces, and I had 3 frames that the art would fit in. So I did pastels, because it was easy and big, and you didn't need to do a lot of work. You know, you just go to it, you know, and blend it with your fingers and stuff. And that's how I did pastels, and then that got popular. I did hay bales, and we had several galleries in different places, and always our own shows too. And
yeah,
we did real well. We sometimes sold like 25, 30 paintings a year, and I would paint 100 paintings, you know. And then of course that gets a little, after a while, you can't do hay bales anymore if you've done that many, you know. And it has changed. You have to leave the houses out now when you do a landscape.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's more houses popping up, more roads, which I paint a lot of little roads, but so I go up people's roads and check it out, and there's more houses, and, you know, things have changed.
And do you mainly sell from your own gallery on Lopez, or do you place your work in other galleries nowadays?
At this point, I'm kind of disappointed and frustrated with galleries, you know. They take half of whatever they sell, and I haven't had one gallery that really did a good job of advertising or promoting or any of these things. I mean, actually work for their money, you know. And I'm tired of schlepping their 20 paintings there, picking up there, and taking it over there, and if they want an original, they'll just have to come to my gallery.
So, Martin, you're not on the road like you were.
I'm not on the road at all.
Wow, so tired.
Do you send announcements to them? Like, don't you want to come and see the new...
Well, we have shows sometimes, you know, once or twice a year. We are at the farmer's market. I have a website. And we have quite a few people that contact me on the website. The word spreads from people that are happy with their dog portraits, for example. We get one or two or three a year, you know, around Christmas time. Suddenly, we need a dog portrait.
You know? Do you find that a website has made a tremendous difference?
Not tremendous, but it has made a difference.
It gives you a place to be contacted. People look up an old poster and say, oh, it says Malay. And they look it up, and there's my website and other information on Google, you know. So
right.
They know how to find us then.
Can you speak a little bit about being selected to have your work hang in the gallery in Olympia this year?
The governor's mansion.
Yes, the governor's mansion.
Aye. Well, you mean what would you like to know about it?
Well, I guess I just would like people to know that you were chosen as the one artist in Washington State this year to have your work on display for an entire year in the mansion.
Did you apply for it? No,
they just came. And they saw, like you said, on the website. So I Googled me, and some people on the island knew some people that, you know, or had something to do with the shows or with the curators in Olympia, and they brought... bunch of people came over, like, what was it, three
Four.
Ladies and their husbands and so on, and confronted me, that's not the right word, is it?
No.
But that's how I felt, sort of.
It like, felt like that,
he
yeah.
said, okay, we have this going, and would you like to have a show, and it hangs for a year, and so on, we need this many paintings, and you have to give a speech for 20 minutes at least.
In front of a whole hall full of people.
More than 100 people. And I had never in my life given a speech, you know, and I'm not much of a talker either. So, you know, I can go, Martin knows, I can go all day without saying a word. And, but, you know, I said, okay, because, you know, here we go, I have a challenge, right?
Mm-hmm.
See if I can do it. I did it. And,
And the speech was not too bad.
No, it took me a long time to write the speech because I had to rewrite it, you know, all the time.
Well, of course.
Like now I really, you know, need to... I've never taken writing classes or anything. It made sense because I read a lot and I know, you know, how to analyze a story or a book or something like that and what's happening. So it needed a beginning and a middle and an end, you know. And I kind of talked about my childhood and how it was in those days and, you know, and... where I grew up and some of the different things we did when we were kids and how it became, or always wanted to be an artist but couldn't or whatever, you know.
Right.
Kind of went into that personal stuff a little bit with some stories about...
And you got lots of applause.
Yeah.
Yes, you did.
And some tears and some laughter.
Oh, yeah.
You might have a new future as a public speaker, my dear.
That's what they said. You said, you know, you should change your job or add to it or whatever, being a public speaker. Yeah. And I don't like that. But it's nice to know
that you prepared for it and it made all the difference in the world.
I intended to do it and I was able to do it. That's important to me.
Mm-hmm. And who knows what will come of the fact that they have been hanging or will be hanging there for... this year, and many people will see it and say, now who was that artist? Mm-hmm. You know, let's look into that.
Yeah. Plus it always looks good on your bio, you know. A little
definitely.
Heck yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's another artist on Lopez whom the three of you knew very well, Hildegard Goss, who passed recently, but I would love to hear the three of... I mean, I knew Hildegard, of course, as a woman, but not as much as an artist, and I would love to hear the three of you tell a little bit about your reminiscences of connecting with her and her life as an artist a bit on Lopez. Allie, maybe you could start by telling about how you and Hildegard met.
Well, Hildegard and I met in the 70s. We were not living here yet, but we were here for the summer. And White Bear, who then was Connie Martin, was doing a storytelling at the Grange. And I was crazy about storytelling, so I made sure I was there. And then during the intermission, a woman came up to me, a white-haired woman, who said, "I'm Hildegard, who are you?" And it was Hildegard Goss who saw another white head in the audience and thought, "I better find out who that is." So that's how we met. So by the time we moved here in 82, we had already made our acquaintance. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Hildegard was very adamant always that she was the one who truly started the Writers Guild. The Artists Guild. And whenever there was something that she didn't agree with, she would say, "Well, you know, I have to talk to them, because after all, I've started it." Yeah.
Yeah.
You were saying a bit earlier that she was quite a instrumental force in encouraging other artists, Ali?
She was a very good mentor. She was excellent in talking with people who were, say, painting, and she would ask them to bring some samples of their work, and then she would talk to them about it. And whenever I heard her do that, she was never what I would call critical. She was encouraging. She was asking questions, and she would make suggestions, but all of it in a very positive way, very positive. Mm. And what I found interesting about her own art, she would always say, "I like to work with other people." She loved to go to artist workshops where everybody would sit at their easel and do something. Mm. You know, she liked that much better than having to do things by herself. Mm. And that was what made her unhappy about writing, because that's a rather lonesome kind of, you know, occupation. You just have to be there and nobody else can really help you. Mm-hmm. And so when she wrote something and I would say, "Now take it and work some more on it," she says, "It's done. Here it is."
Yeah. I think that's how she felt about her art a lot of times. She would do a little doggy, it's a red ball, and nobody knew why that red ball was over in the left corner, but it's done.
It's done. Yeah.
And it worked.
It worked, you know? Yeah, very funny. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I only found out recently that her work sold for quite a bit on Lopez.
Well, people are
at high prices, is what I mean to say.
Artists on this island, you know, yeah. they see somebody coming up too, some young person, and they buy art, and Hildegard died, and so the price doubled, I imagine, you know.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, we met Hildegard, she was our first
visitor.
Self-imposed visitor.
Oh, yeah, that's a word.
When we came to the island, and she came over because she wanted to meet Krista. She understood that there was a new artist on the island, and she was in charge of the library shows. And after visiting, she made sure that Chris got a show at the library right away. So.
Okay. Yeah, and she was just, "Oh, yes, keep doing these children portraits. This is great. And we'll get you lots of customers. We have lots of children on the island." And so on. Of course, you know, she never was instrumental in bringing any of our, you know, customers in, but just to hear her say that makes you feel good.
Yeah. Yeah?
Sure. It's encouraging, and you feel like, "Oh, yeah, I'm on the right track." And so on, and she was a very strong personality.
And what did she look back like back in the day?
Very Swedish. Was she from Sweden? Yeah, red cheeks, blondish white hair, very buxom, I think you would call it. Very.
She came in with a big straw hat on.
Flowers, tons of flowers.
Flowers on the, you know.
Yeah.
Flamboyant back in the day.
Yeah.
And this is Hildegard in her 60s then.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I've been wondering, we came here in the early 80s and we came to retire, you know, retire early and figure out, can we do this financially without going under? And so I've always felt there were a lot of people like us who could not really afford much in the way of buying original art. And then came the 90s with the Microsoft people in their 40s, really, being able to retire. Mm. And did you find that suddenly there was more demand on Ireland for original art?
It seemed like we were, at that time we were in the Gallery 10 in the village.
Right.
And we would sell a lot of paintings to them and get a lot of commissions for views that people had from their windows or large paintings. And yes, that was
for
bigger things.
Specific places in their house.
Yeah.
Because they were building
certain
bigger
spaces,
houses.
They would fill, you know, over the fireplace, had to be a certain size and mm-hmm. so on. And, you know, yeah, you a lot mm-hmm. of...
And so that went on for a while, and then it kind of peaked, and I don't think it's probably as noticeable now, although we have had more people who are independently wealthy who have moved to the island.
Yeah.
So you do have a very different population of the 22 to 2500 that we have now compared to the 800 that we started with.
Yeah.
Well, we certainly feel it in the summer. We get people from Texas, from New York, and from other countries that vacation here and have rented a house, you know, for a week or something, and they want originals, mm-hmm. you know, or at least a limited edition etching or something, you know, that. So it's still okay for us. I mean, we don't have to worry and go somewhere else.
Right. You know? Right.
We notice that they come back every summer as well and make sure that they
bring their guests.
They bring their guests mm-hmm. out to the studio and the gallery that we have now. And
yeah. Or they get on the website at Christmas and says, oh, I saw this print and I need to have it for my wife or something.
mm-hmm.
So it kind of goes word of mouth and good clients, right. Satisfied clients.
Yeah. Which is good, because that's quite a difference from the way it used to be. And it, you know, when the island was smaller, fewer people, and it was probably pretty difficult to find sufficient buyers.
Yeah, that's why we went off island, you know, to Canada and so on,
right.
for major works.
Right.
But the islanders did buy a lot of little mm-hmm. prints and things, and still do. When we have the farmers market, the locals are the ones that are kind of provide the base for us,
right.
you know, a small print of a sheep or you know, that they need to have on the wall.
Like the sheep on my wall.
Yes.
Which also reminds me that the topics, the choice of theme of your artwork, mm-hmm. people want their own scene from their own property. Tell us about it.
Yes, their own view with a certain sunset because they love it so much.
Yeah.
I don't know. And, you know, they could be having... Sometimes they have it hanging right there where the view is, too. And I feel like, I can't compete with nature. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's... I remember that when I was, I think, early on in high school, I had written As Pretty as a Picture. And the teacher wrote, Reality is always prettier than the picture. And that was a very good... Because people tend to say that, you know. It was kind of a cliche that I used.
Yeah. Sure.
See, as a picture, but...
Yeah, it's kind of like people coming up to me and saying, oh, this looks just like a photograph. And, oh, this fringe, you know. But it's a whole different thing. It's a whole, you know, it's not that realistic.
Yeah.
So do you also take license with that, then? With your images?
Of course. I don't go out in the field and sit there with the mosquitoes and the bees and have all my stuff around. It doesn't work that way. I go for hikes and I take lots of photos and take a sketchbook with me and write some ideas and sketches down. Go home and then I put like two or three photos together, move things around. If I don't like this tree over there, well, I'm not going to paint it. Or I leave it out or whatever, you know, just put it somewhere else. Or put some boats in. After a while, the islands, to paint a painting of the islands like this view, I don't even have to be here to paint this or have a photo. I could
it's
just,
somewhere in your
yeah,
head.
Yeah, it's in your head.
Yeah,
you know.
Right.
The light, you know, in the evening
right.
when that breaks across and makes those trees light up.
And you leave out this new...
Yeah, the TV antennas and whatnot. You know, and,
cell towers not in your paintings.
And a lot of times, people... I think some people don't even notice it. Like, I've done some overhead shots, you know, flying overhead with an airplane, mm-hmm. and painting the bay, the fish bay. Left all the houses out. Nobody noticed, but they loved it. Mm. Yeah. I don't know why. I guess yeah. I didn't like the houses. I didn't need them.
No. And probably the people didn't like them either.
Yeah. I was waiting for somebody to come and say, I buy this painting or this print or whatever, if you put my house over there. In the front.
It hasn't happened yet.
No, yes. But we've had things like that.
We've had one case that off the end of, what is the road? They Chris put a dot out at the end of that spit out there, and they bought 8 pieces to give out at Christmas time.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. So in a way you're finding a way on the canvas to capture our emotional attachment to this beautiful place too.
Yeah, you have to be steeped in it to really get the feeling for it, you know, the way the light is and the little roads and not the big fancy view, you know, that you see from the ferry or something with Mount Baker in the back. I don't really like to do that. But yeah, people want to see the island stuff.
Yeah.
Which kind of limits me, but now I'm getting into some more other things. Because I've done hay bales, I've been doing sheep and little roads and, you know, little boats. And after a while, it's like, I know how to do that. Why am I still doing it? I want a challenge, you know, mm-hmm. I want something new. So
what direction are you moving in these days?
Well, it's kind of a storytelling. The viewer will have to tell their own story. Images that... two-dimensional and three-dimensional. Well, the paper is only two-dimensional, mm-hmm. but it's, you know, it's happening in the canvas, like negative, positive. It's hard to explain. You'll have to come over and look at it. I've got a few pieces.
Mm. Wonderful.
Well, lovely. And thank you so much for being here today. This was another edition of Once Upon an Island. Thank you for listening.
This show was pre-recorded.